Hi, the microphone's on. So welcome everyone back from lunch. Welcome again to TechEd. My name is Bill Gibson. I'm a program manager in the SQL organization, Microsoft SQL organization, working particularly these days with Azure SQL Database. And it's my pleasure and delight today to give you guys an overview of Azure SQL Database. Now, before I get started, I thought I'd do a little bit of a kind of audience interaction thing here. So it's kind of cool to know quite who you're talking to. So maybe not personal introductions, but maybe a raise of hands for folks who would think of themselves as developers here today. And those who think of themselves as IT pros. And those maybe who think of themselves as doing both. It's an increasing number. Yes, great. And tell me, how many people here, show of hands again, please, have used Azure SQL Database or are using it now? Oh, that says quite a few of you. That's great. Well, thank you so much for that. Okay, so let's get let's talk about what we're going to do this afternoon. So my objective today then is to provide you an understanding of the way we think about, where we position, and the way you should think about the benefits that you should accrue, you expect to accrue from using the SQL Database product. So Azure SQL Database, a bit of a mouthful, we tend to contract it as just SQL Database, distinct from SQL Server, the box product. Now, there's one thing I want you to take away at the end of this session, so look for all the cues, as it were, as we go through, is that this is a Azure SQL Database is a truly enterprise grade. So that phrase was used by Jason this morning in the keynote. An enterprise grade database as a service platform, which makes tier one capabilities easily accessible to you. And by tier one capabilities, I mean things like high availability, disaster recovery, and scalability. And you're going to see examples of those, and I'll talk about them and demonstrate those as we go through the session. Hit the right keyboard. So how do we position, how do we think about positioning Azure SQL Database? There it is at the top of this continuum, this sort of stack here. And this is something that's, you know, frankly, unique to Microsoft. And we're superbly positioned here with this continuum of SQL products, relational database products, that spans the space from the enterprise and the hardware and software layer where you take complete responsibility, so our so-called box product, through to the cloud. So we transition then, and we have offerings at each of these layers. And indeed, you were hearing a lot this morning about the second of those two, the sort of virtualized layer, the private cloud layer, where you're able to use virtualized hardware and run SQL Server on that. In fact, you heard about the CPS product today that was announced today. So you should go and take a look at that in the exhibition, which is very interesting to see. So we layer up there, and then infrastructure as a service, that layer, the first of the cloud layers, then offering SQL Server on an Azure VM. So again, virtualized machines. Now with SQL Server running on there. So one of the things that's changing as you go through this is obviously we're moving sort of away from the on-premises world into the cloud world, but the costs are going down. And what's significant here is the way the costs can be thought of. At the bottom left there with hardware and software, your own responsibility, that's very much a capital expenditure focused initiative. You know, you have to invest upfront, in both hardware and software, and you have to invest in administration of both of those layers. Whereas if you go up the stack, there's an increasingly small amount of investment. And you get to the platform as a service layer where SQL Database resides, there's effectively no investment required from you at all, and effectively zero administration, running virtualized databases frankly, invisible hardware. So the hardware is simply abstracted away from your problem space completely. There's no administration costs, there's no maintenance, there's no software patching. It's all managed for you. So it's a completely managed service where you are just provisioning databases as and when you need them. So then let's talk about that a little more and talk about the sort of focus of the session today. So then a relational database as a service. So it's the platform as a service layer. It's fully managed by Microsoft. And the kind of design point for us here is to focus on databases for cloud-designed apps. So typically new applications being built for the cloud where these enterprise-grade features are required. So you want to run better business applications, but you want to run them in the cloud with cloud economics without this upfront investment. And you don't want the costs to you of administration, which means that small organization startups can get started in the cloud tremendously quickly. There's very, very low upfront investment. You just create a database and go. It's creating a database is a matter of seconds. There's no elaborate preamble there. Get yourself an Azure subscription and you're ready to go. So then the three topics I'm going to pick up on today and focus on are these three here, of scale and performance, and I'll talk about scalability in both scaling up, increasing the power and the size of a database, as well as scaling out, talking about the ability to run a platform across a logical database platform across many databases. And you'll see how we can monitor and manage performance, which is instructive in this scaling process. Then business continuity and data protection. And I'll show you and talk about how we provide self-service, self-managed recovery and restore capability and support disaster recovery scenarios. And you'll see how compliance and security has been sort of built into the platform as well. So these are critical things as you think about moving business-critical applications of yours onto the cloud. And then finally, this idea of being self-managed and familiar. Self-managed is going to come up all the time through the presentation. There's no point where you need to call support to ask us to do anything for you. You're able to, and we provide you the tools for managing all aspects of the service. And we provide a portal, but also programmatic APIs, and I'll talk a little bit more about those. But that won't be much of the focus of the day. And then this idea that it's still more of SQL. So it's a familiar platform for you, a familiar language. Our goal here is to reduce the barrier to adoption, any sort of speed bumps on your route to the cloud. Okay, so let's talk about how we package and deliver the service before we get into those three tiers. So this is an important change that's occurred in the last few months. We've now released to general availability our new service tiers, basic, standard, and premium. These upgrade and effectively replace the previous editions, web and business edition, that we offered the service in before. Web and business edition continue to be supported, but they are going to be retired, and they will be retired in September 2015. So you can continue to use those. But all our focus going forward now is on this way of thinking about and packaging the service. And I'll make this more real for you as we go through today. So basic then, our sort of entry-level service tier, targeted at light transactional loads, lightweight, often infrequently used databases. In fact, the majority of databases that are currently implemented in the cloud fall into this category. Standard, we think of as our go-to option for business applications. So here we've got a range of a solid range of business continuity features and a range of performance that meets the requirements of most business applications. And then our premium service tier, which is focused on the highest throughput applications and business critical applications. So it has the most strictest performance and the most sort of rich and robust business continuity features. But if you look down there, you can see that the availability SLA, the uptime guarantee from Microsoft, is the same across all of these. And with these service tiers, we've increased this from 99.9% to 99.99% now. So a 4.9 service And if you take a basic database, right now they're about $250 a month. It's going to be $5 a month shortly. But at that point, you know, a 99.99% uptime guarantee on a database that costs about the same as a cup of coffee for a month there. On the size now, whereas with web and business, we offered a maximum size of 150 gigabytes in the business edition. We've now scaled the maximum size to 250 gigabytes for standard and up to 500 for premium. And as you'll see, I'm going to talk a lot more about performance and business continuity. We have options there for increased performance. Not only do we increase the performance across the tiers, but we give you scalability options within each of the tiers. So each of standard and premium has multiple performance levels, as we refer to them, allowing you to scale up and down within those tiers, as well as scaling between the tiers. And in the business continuity space, we have a full backup and geo-redundant recovery story for all the databases, but you'll see it's a more robust story in the standard and still more so in the premium tier with introducing geo-replication. And I'll be talking about that as we go. Okay, so let's take a look at the first of these. I'm going to drill down into the elastic scale and performance area. So if we look at the performance challenge, and one of the aspects of performance that's important is the idea of predictability in performance. If you look at this little sort of graphic here, so our web and business editions operated in this manner. That is, there was effectively a machine, and from the standpoint of a database, we can characterize the machine as offering us an amount of compute supporting read and write I/O and memory. So you can think of that as a bounding box then, a sort of set of dimensions which describe how much capacity, resource capacity, was available for the databases. In web and business, those resources are shared amongst a set of databases that are on that machine. Because of our high availability architecture, the actual databases are moving around effectively all the time. At any moment in time, you can't tell whose databases are on any one machine. Now, this is a very effective architecture. It works very well most of the time, but it does suffer from one drawback, which is that because the individual databases, as you can see there, can actually burst and they can change their performance profile, any one customer at any one time is liable to do that. And that produces an effect that, as you can imagine, is less desirable for all the other residents on that, the other tenants on that machine. That is, a particular database, if it suddenly bursts, consumes a large amount of resources, effectively denies some of those resources to the other databases. And in fact, the effect can be significant enough that it can throttle the other databases and cause connections to be dropped. Now, we've worked hard to minimize this effect, but it's still a fundamental characteristic of that architecture. So we heard from you, from our customers, very clearly that predictable performance was important. So the problem with this, of course, is that you can't predict when this is going to happen. It could be anybody's database that could do that at any moment. You know, some other company decides to run a performance test, and that was the kind of ironic example. They would do a performance test, thrash the heck out of a database, and that would sort of effectively bring down the performance of the entire machine and the other databases. So what was the fix for that? The fix for that was to give each database a box. Now, instead of all the databases sharing a box, we now think about a bounding box expressed the same way in terms of compute, memory, read and write I/O, but to give that for each of the databases. Now you can clearly see how they're constrained, and now instead of throttling when you hit the edges of the box, your app is effectively just slowed down. Your database transactions are slowed until the resources they consume are reduced sufficient to allow your database to continue to operate. So that's the big change that's gone on, and that's how we can deliver now extremely predictable performance. And I'll give you more evidence of that in a moment. So this picture here makes it look like all the boxes are the same size, but guess what? The performance is scalable too. So we now offer a series of, through those service tiers, and the performance levels within those service tiers, we offer a range of box sizes, effectively the amount of compute, the amount of resources available to the databases. So I've used the sort of coloring scale there. Basic is shown in orange, standard in green, and premium in blue. And we measure the size, the difference in size, the relative size of those boxes with a unit we've sort of introduced. We've coined this notion of a database throughput unit, or a DTU. And it's not intended as an absolute measure. It's intended as a relative measure so that you can understand the relative performance of these boxes. So if you run an application and run a particular workload on a, let's pick an example here, on an S1 database. S1 has 20 DTUs. And then if I find I don't have the throughput or the response time that I want, and I choose to scale up and I pick, for example, a P1 database at 100 DTUs, then I would expect to get 5 times the throughput, 5 times the capacity. Now, it's not necessarily repeatable in all cases because it depends on what might be the bounding factor for your particular workload. But for general workloads that are not particularly bound by any one of the dimensions, then this rule holds well and true. So a DTU then is a blended measure of CPU, read I/O, write I/O, and memory, and it's most particularly kind of linked to CPU. Now, you can scale the performance of a database up and down, so you can change it from any one of the performance levels, change it from any one of the service tiers. You can do this via the portal. We have REST APIs and PowerShell that lets you do this too. And, of course, you can do this through T-SQL. So there's a wide range of ways that you can actually access this scalability and invoke this. And you typically will do this, and I've said here to reflect actual or anticipated demand. The thing to bear in mind is that when we scale the databases, these are not sort of second-by-second changes. This is not something you use to respond to moment-by-moment changes in demand from a database. Just think of this as predicting demand or scaling for changes day by day, week by week, or perhaps seasonal changes in your throughput requirements. And you know, why is that? Well, because those, if you just think about it for a moment, those boxes are of different sizes. We have to fit those boxes onto a machine. So you can sort of think of the jigsaw puzzle that we're doing to fit your database among other databases onto a machine. And we're also doing this not just on one machine, but we maintain 3 replicas. So we have to have space in all 3 machines that are hosting the copies of your database. So that the 3 replicas then is the backbone of our HA, our high availability infrastructure. So scaling up very often will require us to pick a database out of one machine and place it somewhere else. So it's a copy operation. And so that's a size of data operation. And it can actually take many hours to scale up a database. It's not instantaneous at all. So predicting change is most effective. Changes, for example, between basic and S0 are very fast, and you'll see that in a moment. Changes of large databases up to the larger tiers can take a considerable period. So you just need to plan ahead for that. Critical as you to bear in mind that as you're doing the scaling, the database, it's an online operation. Your database stays online throughout the operation. If we have to copy the database from one machine to another, then there may be a brief moment at the end of the copy operation as the new tier comes alive, the new performance level comes alive, where we drop connections. But you should be using resilient connection design standards in your patents and your application. So that will be no more than a normal drop and reconnect type event. And we've changed also, the other thing we changed was from a daily billing model to an hourly billing model. So now when you do make these transitions from scaling up and scaling down, the billing model much more closely reflects the change you made. So it's a more cost-efficient model for you to make these transitions. Okay, so how do you know when to make these changes. So monitoring and measurements and providing metrics is a key part of the story here, and you'll see that in a moment. So we have a rich near real-time monitoring capability. I was able to change the slide title just over the weekend. We actually, over the weekend, released a still finer grain monitoring capability. So we now offer, if you scope to 1 hour, you can see the performance effectively 15-second intervals. So you're seeing a very near real-time view of the performance. And it's actually very interesting for us because by bringing that capability online, we've made it much clearer the bursting capability, the bursting kind of characteristics of databases. And you'll be able to see that yourselves as you watch the performance responding to the demand and the throughput of your application. You can also set alerts and notifications, and I'll show you one of these in a moment. And so that as the database crosses above or below a threshold that you define, you can have an alert fired. That alert can come into the portal, or you can have it send email, so you can be notified remotely of a change. So you can, for example, set a threshold at 75 or 80% of the DTU capacity of the database, so you can be alerted to an increase and prepare yourself for scaling. And we provide dashboard views. You'll see those in a moment in the portal. And you can use APIs to retrieve this monitoring information, as well as DMVs through T-SQL. And then there are further DMVs that you can use for troubleshooting. So if you're finding that, in fact, your performance is not what you expect, that you're consuming resources, don't forget that a whole other angle of attack here, instead of scaling up the performance of the database, is to tune your application. So there are a range of DMVs and other support mechanisms that will help you to tune and optimize your application. We'll be doing more work in this area, so watch out in this space. Okay, so let's take a look at this. Right, so if you've used Azure, then you'll be familiar with this general portal. If you've used the SQL database extension, then you can see here I've got a couple of databases open. Now, I'm actually going to show you the demonstration today in our new preview portal, so I'll switch over to that in a second. But this is what you've probably used today and you recognize most. To get to the preview, the first thing you can do is come here to the previews page. And there's a big, this is in fact the very first thing that shows up now. There's a list of previews that you can get to here, which include previews of many of the Azure services. There's one down in here for auditing for SQL database, which is one of our most recent previews. But this main button here would let you launch the new portal. You can also get to it from here by dropping down from your subscription, your sign on, and you can switch the new portal here. I already have it open, so I'm just going to jump to it. Right, so that's the new portal. And it's quite a different experience. It's a much more sort of object-oriented experience, and you'll see as I go through this little demonstration here some of the characteristics. One of the nice things is this sort of health map that you see at the beginning. It shows you the state of the Azure service around the world. In fact, interestingly, you can see there are two new data centers that are online now in Australia, which are available for Australian and New Zealand customers. Okay, so show you how easy it is to create a database. I'm going to go through here. I hit the plus new down there. Let's do that again. A bit too quick. Hit plus new in the corner here, then I'm going to pick everything. There are a range of services available here, but if you want to get everything, you use this button, come down, and in the data and analytics space, you scroll down and you can see here SQL database. And this sort of little sales spiel for SQL database here, followed by the create button at the bottom. and it opens up a database create blade. So so we refer to the idea of a journey, which is a sort of progression across the screen. So you're seeing the sideways scrolling. So the journey then comprises many blades, and these blades actually have vertical scrolling on them. So if the blade extends beyond the screen, you can scroll up and down the individual blades, and you'll see that in a moment. And so you go on these journeys, and then you complete work, and you go in and out, and then that's how you progress through the... So I'm going to just create a database here. So I just want to show you how this works here. So these are our pricing tiers. These are our recommended ones. So standard S0 is our sort of like, as I said, it's our sort of go-to performance level and service tier. But we can bring out the whole set of performance tiers, pricing tiers. And you can see the range of premium ones at the top, standard, and then basic. And you can continue to create web and business editions. But you can see they're marked as retired now. And you can see on each of these that the number of DTUs that are provided is highlighted here. So it's this first element. And then there are other characteristics. You can see up to 500 gigabytes for premium. Here the standard databases have up to 250 gigabytes. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm happy with the S0. I then configure a server. Now, a server in a SQL database is a logical concept. It's just a grouping of databases. It doesn't represent an instance, a SQL Server instance running on a machine. It's a group of databases that you can manage collectively. So, for example, you could delete a server, and it would delete all the databases on that server. You also can set firewall rules, and you can set logins on there. So you can control and administer set of databases collectively. So I could pick an existing server. I can do that. And that gets me a default resource group. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time on the resource group notion, but resource groups then are an Azure concept which represents a grouping of resources. I guess that's pretty obvious from the name. But the idea of a resource group, and it's kind of best thought of if you think of the analogy of an application. What is an application? Well, it's a website, and it's a network. It's running on a VM, and it's got a database. Well, then it's a collection of those resources I would put into a resource group, and now I could manage that resource group collectively. I could grant access control, access rights, access privileges to that all the resources in the resource group by granting those rights to the resource group itself, for example. So that's the role of a resource group in a nutshell. So I go ahead and create this. And it's going to pop the database here, a tunnel onto the start border representing that database. And it'll take a few seconds to create the database. And actually, I'm going to move on from this while it's doing that. I'm going to do something else here. So we talked a lot about performance, and we talked about scalability. And what I want to do is try and give you a kind of feel for that. So let's take a look at another database. I've got a database I've already built called LoadRun. And it's called LoadRun because it's going to support a load running. I'm using it to run a load against this. In fact, you can see it's running right now. I actually have a VM on which I have a tool, and I'll show you the tool in just a moment, that is hitting this database with a workload. This is a real workload. And it's, you know, there it is. There's our monitor showing me the performance here. And this is a DTU utilization. And if I drop out of there for a moment, you can see it's ranged from being fully loaded to being quite lightly loaded at various times. So I have a load that is a mix of transactions that are hitting that. So let's go and take a look at that. So this is my engine that's driving this. It's sitting on and I don't want to spend a lot of time sort of dwelling on this, but it's sitting on a VM in also in Azure, also in the West Europe region, in the data center. And right now, it's got, the way this is configured, I can have up to 13 users, 13 threads running against this database. And right now, I've got 6 threads running. and they're submitting transactions 1 a second. So I'm hitting just under 6 transactions a second on a basic database. So that's a pretty respectable rate for a small database. You know, you could run a small business on that, 6 transactions a second. You know, if you're a small operation, that's definitely not to be sneezed at. But what happens if I pump up this? So let me just show you what's going on here. I have, there are two kind of measures that are interesting when you look at load, when you apply a load to a database. One is the transaction rate, how many transactions a second can I get here? And the other one is how long does each transaction take? What's the response time? And, you know, the answer, that, you know, as someone setting this up, I want to get a reasonable transaction rate with good response time. So at the moment, there are these two columns here, which is average response time and fence here. And you can see that we're actually doing pretty well. 100%, so this fence here represents the percentage of transactions that take more than 1 second to complete. So at the moment, most of these are either at 100 or close to 100. I'm not quite sure what's going on with this guy. So we're actually running quite sort of healthily at the moment. But what I'm going to do down here is I'm going to come and increase the load on this here. And I do that just by popping up the number of threads. So I'm now going to push the transaction rate up higher on this. And in fact, if we come back to here, so what we'll see, let's go back again. You'll see this transaction rate has gone up, but it's not doubled, notice. We haven't been able to double the transaction rate. And what we'll see rapidly is the response time now is degrading. So whereas before we had most response times were of the order of a second or less, let's take a look here. We can see now we're getting some that are significantly higher, 4 seconds, 2.5 seconds, 4.5 seconds, 2.5 seconds, and so on down here. So the response time is clearly degraded. So really, I've just gone beyond the limits of this basic. So this is the kind of, you know, I've burst the application. If this was to be a sustained increase in performance, then my customers are now suffering from this degraded response time. So I would want to do something about that. We come back here. Though it was kind of noisy and bouncy before, we basically pushed it up now, and we're at 95%, and it's going to carry on at this rate here. And we'll see this as it, if we were to come back and look at this in a moment, we will see this as basically pushed up to the top, and it's going to be running along the top now, pretty much at full capacity. You can see there's, let me just let a couple of those click in for a second there. So what can we do about that? Well, the short answer, of course, is to scale the application, scale the database. So let's come down here and do that. In fact, what I'm going to do is with that over there. So we're running at around 7 transactions, and you can see the response time there. So let's go ahead and scale this. And I'm going to scale this just to an S0. That's a very fast transition to make that, so it's a good for a demonstration. And we're going to see, almost immediately, we're going to see this transaction rate go up and the response time come down again. So we've now taken a database that was pretty much at its limit, and we've given it sort of breathing headroom now by making that scaling action. So there you can see the effect of that immediately. We're now at 12 transactions, 12 or 13, and if we were to go look at this here, we can see that the you know, whilst we clearly pinned it for a while at the top there at 100%, we've now dropped right down again. And again, if we were to let this run, we'll see this is now running at a healthy level again. Somewhere, basically, we've put it back to the healthy state it was in before I upped the load, because I doubled the load on that database when I increased from 6 to 13 users there, more than doubled it. 13 is a lucky number, by the way, that's why I picked that. Okay, so let's come back. So we saw the new management portal. You've seen how to get into it, how to create a database there. It's a little kind of circuitous, that path. That's why I was keen to show you that. And you've seen the way we've been able to monitor and use the service tiers and the performance levels to scale the database. So we've seen that kind of story there. Okay, so that's the first scalability dimension. That's the dimension of we refer to as vertical scaling, where we can increase the size and capacity of a database. But there's also the horizontal scaling notion, the ability to scale a database out in the other direction. And this model here, this is often referred to as a sharded model. Typically, it's done by distributing data based on some key, some sharding key, that is used to distribute values of data across multiple databases. So this approach then is not orthogonal. Although it's orthogonal to the first scale up versus scale out, they're not independent, mutually independent, or exclusive. So I can use the same vertical scaling notion within this horizontal scaling pattern as well. So I can actually take individual databases that are in a sharded set and scale them up and down. So let's take a look at this sharding technology. This has just been released. It's now in preview. And this allows us to scale to literally thousands of databases if required. It's effectively a sort of boundless scale using this sharded pattern. It's implemented using .NET client libraries, which are consumed by your application. So it's a client-side solution. And these libraries enable, together with service tier components and a shard map, which is managed in an extra database sitting on the server, allows you to manage the set of shards. In fact, map keys to shards and supports operations that act on a shard and allow you, for example, to split a shard at a point of your choosing, creating two shards where there was one, and moving the data from the original shard into the two shards. It also supports merging shards. So you split when, for example, a particular customer or a range of customers becomes hot. You've got either more processing or more data, so you want more space, so you now split the database. So this is basically using a multi-tenant style architecture spread across multiple databases. There are various strategies, sharding strategies you can use. You can use temporal based keys for example, managing data across time. So you can have a time series with, for example, today's sales or today's transactions in one database, yesterday's transactions in another database, and so on. And they could be aged back over time. And you might then apply different performance levels. You may give a high performance level to today's database, its data, and then scale down the performance requirements of older databases. Clients can, so the client application can, although there's no distributed query as such, at the database level, there are libraries, there's library support for submitting queries and then joining the results, unioning the results from across multiple shards and then presenting those back to the client. And there is support also for various management operations which can be fanned out asynchronously across the set of shards. So you can, for example, create or drop indexes, submit schema changes, or for example, update reference data that you want to have in each of the databases. You can set tasks off to do that across the set of shards. So then this set of libraries and this capability then simplifies the development and management of this whole class of scale-out application. Okay, so that's our scalability story, and you saw me demonstrate the... so that last section, and in fact, both performance and scalability, we have other sessions this week, and I'll give you pointers to those. So you can, there'll be drill downs into each of those topics. So if you're interested in either of those sort of areas, there are sessions on those that you should go to later. So let's take a look at the business continuity and data protection space then. So the story around recovery and restore. So the first kind of element of this is, think of this as data protection. So this is the way we use backups. So the first point, of course, is just that there are backups. You don't have to to set this up. It's automatic and continuous. We're actually taking backups every of the logs on databases every 5 minutes. And those backups, and we have sort of weekly, daily, and log backups every 5 minutes. Those backups are stored, I use the word locally, sort of in a sort of wide notion here. This is locally, they're stored within the data center in which your database resides. So these log backups then are retained, these backups in general are retained for different periods depending on the service tier of the database. So a basic database, we retain the backups for 7 days, for a standard database for 14 days, and premium for 35 days. Now, the daily backups are also copied to a remote data center in case of a disaster. So let's talk about the two scenarios that are enabled through our backup story here. The first one is, we love to call this the oops recovery scenario. So this is recovery from accidental corruption, data corruption, or data deletion. So there's various ways this can happen. It could be human error. It could be someone deleting a database. It could be someone just simply entering bad data into a database. Or it could be a bug in a program, which has corrupted the database. So you can go back in time, so to any point in the, to within a minute at least, to any point within the retention period, you can pick a point in time where you want to recover to. And we will create a database for you from that is based on that backup. We always create a new database. We don't overwrite the database that you're restoring to. So that's a difference from SQL Server on the box. If you've deleted a database, then we will recover to the point in time. You can recover that database to the point in time at which it was deleted. So that's the sort of oops recovery story. And then there's the data center disaster story. Now, it's never happened, and hopefully never will happen, that we lose a data center. But should there be some natural catastrophe that takes out a data center in which your databases or your other services are housed, then Microsoft has got plans across the board for recovering your data to another site. So this here, then, is how you would recover your database. If you were, you'll see there are more advanced options in available for standard and premium, but this is the most basic level that we offer here, which is to restore from one of those daily backups from the remote site. You can restore the database to any other location you wish. And you can use this at any time. You can use it now. You don't need to wait for a disaster. But you will be restoring a copy that is up to 24 hours old. So you will have up to 24 hours, so the recovery point objective, the RPO, is less than 24 hours for these databases. There's no charge for taking backups, so this is a completely automatic service. It's part of the SQL database service to have these backups taken, including the remote backups. But you will be charged when you restore from one of these because you always create a new database. So the database you create will just be a normal database that incurs normal charges. And in the kind of oops scenario, a kind of common pattern, of course, will be to recover or to restore a database alongside your production database and then to make a decision about whether you choose to have your application now effectively connect to the recovered database or to copy data out of that database and migrate it into your production database. That's the most common scenario, typically, to recover just some of the data and apply that to the production database. And that, in the point in time restore, let's make sure you understand that is... You can restore back to 5 minutes ago. So, pretty much as soon as you realize something's gone wrong, you can restore the database back to that point and pick the point immediately before the incident occurred. So let's go and look at the next level, which uses geo-replication. So geo-replication then is our technology for replicating transactions from one database against another database. I mentioned asynchronous geo-replication. That's significant because by doing this asynchronously, the replication load doesn't slow down, doesn't throttle your main the main load on your primary database when you set this up. So that's an important aspect of the replication story. You're not waiting for the replica to hit the remote location, or the transaction to be duplicated there before you get a response back from your original transaction on the primary. So we have two geo-replication-based offerings here. We refer to them as standard geo-replication and active geo-replication. But really, they just differ by an option you'll see, which is, what kind of secondary do you want? Do you want a readable secondary or a non-readable secondary? So standard geo-replication uses a non-readable secondary. So it creates a non-readable secondary. And I say it's optional here because recognize that in both of these options, you are creating additional databases, so you will be charged additionally for these. These are not built-in features of the service. You're opting into these geo-replication techniques. In the first one, which creates a non-readable secondary, it does that in a paired region. So it's a Microsoft-designated paired region. And we have all regions are paired up one with another inside a geographic territory in Azure. So we have several of these geos around the world, and inside there, each region is paired with another one. So that's the region to which you can replicate using standard geo-replication. And it will create a non-readable secondary, which means it's there in case of disaster, but you can't access that secondary normally. It's not available to you for load balancing, for example. And because it's not readable, it's not accessible, we actually charge a discounted rate for that second database. To fail over to that database, basically Microsoft will enable failover if there is an incident that has basically brought down a data center, and it will enable it for all on all secondary databases of this kind. So at that point, or from that point, you can then choose to fail over. You can basically turn that non-readable database into a readable database and then connect your application to it and continue. So during replication, there's a very, very short, I mean, it depends on your workload because of the asynchronous nature of replication. It's typically a very, very short period between a transaction hitting the primary and it being replicated to the secondary. So the data loss potential here is much, much less. I mean, it's now we're in the orders of seconds or minutes, if any at all. Obviously, it depends on the workload your database was encountering at the time the data center went down. You can also, with standard geo-replication, let me just sort of add a graphic here for that, you can fail over at any time you like in a drill kind of context. So for a drill scenario, you can try this out at any point and basically liberate the and make readable the secondary database. But you know, that's not going to help you in at a moment of a disaster, of course, because you can't, unless you happen to be thinking about this at the moment it occurred, you won't be able to predict when that's going to happen. But it is interesting for you, and it's important for a DR drill standpoint, for compliance reasons, for many people, to be able to test out these scenarios and work through them. Okay, so then that's standard geo-replication. Let's talk about active geo-replication, which is only available for premium databases. And for this, you can have up to four readable secondaries. I say up to four because if you choose to have a non-readable secondary, it would count towards that limit of four. So there's an example where a database has been replicated to three readable secondaries and one non-readable secondary. Now, you have full control over the location. You can replicate these to any point in the the network of regions, to any Azure region. And you can fail over at any time as well. So you have full control of that. So if there is a disaster, you're not in any way waiting for Microsoft to do anything. If for your business it's critical to recover instantly and not even wait for the possibility of the original region coming back up, then you can go ahead and commit to a failover earlier if you choose. Because of that, this technology also supports other scenarios. You can use this for load balancing. So those databases are readable, so you can connect read workloads to those secondary databases. So you could use that, for example, for a global application. Oh, and you can keep a replica in the same region as well, if you wish. So you can create a replica. It won't help you for disaster recovery, but it would give you another database that is being replicated to for load balancing purposes. You also can use this for simply copying a database from one location to another, or for example, making a copy of a database immediately prior to doing an upgrade of an application. So you could set up a copy, have a synchronous copy, a geosynchronous copy established in another location, and then cut that at the moment you start an application or a database upgrade. And if something goes wrong during that upgrade, you know you've got a copy that was made immediately prior to that upgrade starting. You could fail the application over to. So there are various ways you can think about using this this technology. And again, this has got the fastest RPO and RTO. Basically, the RPO is typically less than 5 minutes. It just depends. So if a disaster occurs, recognize the only things that wouldn't be copied would be transactions that were in flight at that moment that hadn't yet been replicated. So that's the only data loss that might occur. So it's typically it's just a few seconds worth of data might be lost. And then the time to failover now is entirely dependent on you and when you choose to actually initiate the failover. Failover itself is only a matter of seconds or minutes to accomplish. It's not a complex procedure, although there's more to it than just failing over the database. You've got an application to fail over and connections to reestablish. So this level of geo-replication then offers the highest level of protection for a business. Okay, so let's go and take a look at that. So that was the database we were looking at before. I'm now going to open up another database, good old AdventureWorks. And we're now going to pay attention to a rather different graphic on here. So the resource utilization is, well, actually it's zero because I'm not doing anything with this database. But what's interesting about this database, I'm going to scroll, and this is, you can see this scrolling, vertical scrolling on a blade. I'm going to bring down into view this guy down here, which is the geo-replication part. So I'm going to click on this. Do it again, there we go. And that brings up a geo-replication control for me. So we're now going to use, and this is like one of those how cool is this moments, we've got a map where you can see the location of the database and all the available regions. So the regions that are available to you, and notice, because I'm not an Australian resident, I don't have Australia data centers available to me. So that's an interesting case in point there. And highlighted on here, let me just zoom in again. Highlighted on here is the location of my database here, the region in which it's located, and the recommended region for geolocation. So this is for geo-replication. This is the paired region that I talked about before. So this guy here, so this is actually West Europe, and that's North Europe. That's interesting use of the compass there. So North Europe is the paired region, the recommended region. But I'm going to be bold, and what I'm going to do, and I can just do this directly on the map. I'm going to set up you can see as I hover over the map, it turns into a little plus sign saying you could add a replica here. So I'm going to go ahead and click here. This is the Japan West region, and I'm going to create a replica there. So I'm going to replicate this database over there, and it has the same name. The performance level must be the same or higher than the source to ensure that the replication onto the target is not going to slow down or in any way throttle the source. So you always have to have the same or higher performance level on the target. And I'm going to pick, I can pick what kind of replica to create, readable or non-readable. I'm going to pick a readable. And I'm going to make use of a server that exists already over there. So there's BG West Japan. Go ahead and pick that. And I'm going to go ahead and create this. So now it's going to create this replica. It's going to create a database in Japan. It's going to do it right now. In fact, it's done it. There it is. The database now exists. And it's going to establish a replication link between here and Japan. And it's going on now. So it's creating the database. And it's going to start the seeding process. We'll get to that in just a second. And it's not a very big database, so this should take place within the confines of this session. And while it's starting up there, I'm going to set up another one. I'm going to set up the one in, and I could go ahead and create all four here. And this time I'm going to make this a non-readable. So this is, I'm going to use my local tiered region as the location which I'm going to use for backup purposes. So I'm going to make that a non-readable so I can get a discount from that. You can see there's a percentage information beginning to be displayed here. And I'm going to again pick a server. I created one here, BG North Europe. I'm going to pick that. Go ahead and create that. And that will now do the same thing and establish the other link here. So it can, I could set up to four of those, but probably two's enough to prove the point. And in a moment, we will see that the first one I set up will complete. You can see the status of it here. So the second one is initializing, the first one is seeding. We don't actually get status responses very frequently at the moment. We'll get this tighter. It went from 0% to 99%, and in a second it'll jump to being complete. Notice as I hover over here, I can actually add more databases in the same region. This is not a picture of the database, it's a picture of the region in which the database is located. So that's the point there. Okay, so while it's doing that, I'm going to do something else here. I'm going to open up, in fact, I'm going to open up my favorite tool. I'm going to open up SSDT in Visual Studio. So here's to make the point that we can use the tools that we're familiar with Azure databases. So, you know, here I am. I've actually got this is opened up already over the, this is, let me just highlight here. This is the AdventureWorks database in BG Europe. So you remember that was the primary database. This is the source database that we're using for replication. And then I'm going to open up, and you can see now, by the way, that this is completed. So we've got both replicas established, so that didn't take long. This is a small database. It is a size of data operation, replicating. So don't expect a large database to many gigabytes to be replicated as quickly as this. But obviously, once it's replicated, it's in what's called catch-up mode. So therefore, thereafter, it's just applying transactions that occur on the primary. It's routing those over to the secondary and then applying those to the secondary. And if you look at the difference in the icons here, this guy's got a little padlock on it to show that that's where a non-readable database is located. And this has got just the clear check mark here to indicate that's where a readable secondary is located. Right, so the other half of this then is to open up another tool, another well-known tool. So this is SSMS. So I've got, in fact, what I need to do is refresh this. So this guy is opened over West Japan, the server in West Japan. And this was from an earlier run of my. So I'm going to refresh this, take a couple of moments. So remember what it's doing, it's connecting to that database in Japan and pulling back server information. Going to. Let's get rid of that. Expand the database. There's the adventure. So this database here was just created. That's the one that we've just replicated. And you know, it has the same set of tables in it that this guy's got, of course. So let's open up a query, and I'm just going to drop this in there. So what we're going to do is I'm going to make some changes to a table in West Europe, and we're going to see if the data is replicated. And you know it's going to work, because I wouldn't show this to you otherwise. So here we go. So this is, if you are familiar with AdventureWorks, this is the product category table in which kinds of widgets that AdventureWorks sell are described. So there's bits for bikes, basically. And if, the bits for bikes are product category 2. So I'm going to go ahead and use the data entry form in in the Visual Studio SQL Server data tools here. And we're going to, there's a new kind of, so I don't know if you've seen these, the new electric wheels. I don't think they were thought of in the days of, so these are wheels that have got like a powered hub. So that's there, and we execute this query over here. There we can see electric wheels, and we can go ahead and add another one, as if you need to see it twice. So there's a battery added over there, and we run the query again, and the battery over there. So you see that? There we go. So electric wheels and battery now just turned up in Japan. So I'm able now to query this database in Japan for data that I put into it in Amsterdam. Actually, that's where the database is located. But if I were to try and run a query against it here, an update query, so let me try and insert. Let's put some another category in there, LED lights, and let's try and run that. And it's going to it's going to fail to do that. And you can see the reason that it fails is, of course, it's a secondary database, which is in no cases updatable. They're either not readable or readable, but never updatable. Never updatable until you do this. So let's go and bring back. So here's our geo-replication set there. And so what I can do now is walk up to the database. So the databases are listed here as secondaries, and I can see whether they're readable or non-readable. Again, just make sure you see that. And then I can click here, and I can stop the replication to that. And by stopping replication, basically I break it off from this replication sort of family that we've created here. So we've got three databases that are sort of joined at the hip here, and I can actually split these replicas away now. So, and this one here, which is readable, so this is the one using what we refer to as active geo-replication. This one, I have a choice. This is one where I've got full control. I can say, I could stop it immediately, which would be a sort of disastrous, disaster mode kind of notion. So that would be mimicking a case where I might lose transactions. Or I can say stop after sync, in which case it will stop the database after finishing any remaining buffered transactions and sending those over there. So let's go ahead and say yes to that. And you can see it will break that link in just a moment. Okay, and I think I should move on here. Go on, break. Honestly, we'll break that in just a moment. Let's come back. Look at that in a moment. Okay, so we've seen then a demonstration of geo-replication, and you've seen how I was able to use it. You almost saw how I was able to use it for in a disaster recovery scenario. Here we go. It's done it now. Let's show you that. There you are. It's broken the link there. So if I were to now go and find that database, it would be a freestanding read-write database that I could use, and I could connect my application to completely independently. So that's what's happened. Okay, so we saw then the disaster recovery kind of usage and then load balancing, at least in as much as you saw me run queries against that other database. So let's keep going. So last part of our middle tier then, the notion of compliant and secure. So the SQL database platform is itself verified compliant as part of the range of certifications that are done for the Azure platform as a whole. So there's a range of certification standards that we comply with. There's still various elements of security that you're responsible for as you create the application and configure the application. So security isn't something that's just built in entirely. You still need to use secure client connections to your application. You need to configure firewalls to restrict IP ranges. There's a general principle of using least privilege, which of course is just good practice, and then protecting against SQL injection. These are all the sort of well-established principles, but you know, you still need to do these. There's, you know, SQL database doesn't remove your obligation to address these issues. And then we've recently, to add to this notion of security, then we've introduced support for auditing. So this is user-controlled, user-managed auditing. So this allows you to maintain an audit log. The audit log is actually managed in Azure Storage, and then you can access that log. And you can use that, and turning on auditing is simple. It's a preview, by the way, so at the moment you need to go to that preview site that I mentioned before and actually check on the auditing button there to have a go with this. But once you've done that, you can then configure this easily on a database. And once you've done that, you have access to that audit log information, and you can run all sorts of interactive analyses that will tell you not only sort of audit-worthy, security-oriented, and provide you that level of information, but it'll provide you potentially with a whole range of operational insights into your application. Now, you can now dig into and analyze what actually is being done to the database. So you can, we can see all management changes, schema changes, and DML changes. So you can track all of those changes through the auditing system. So the final sort of pillar here, that of self-managed and familiar. This is very quick, there's no demo here. So the first point I've already touched on several times, the notion of zero administration. So this virtualized infrastructure, you've seen how easy it is to create databases. You just create databases when you need them. There's no concern for managing the infrastructure. So there's no patching, there's no maintenance, there's no hardware to fail on you. Nothing for you to worry about on your watch. Fault-tolerant platform, automatic backups, all of that just built into the service. And then the management that you do need to care about, things like copying databases, configuring, and deleting, restoring, auditing, is all self-service. Self-service either through the portal or through REST APIs. Our portal is built over those REST APIs, or through PowerShell, PowerShell scripts, and T-SQL, of course. So all of those are available through T-SQL. And then familiar development tools and platforms. And I hope you got the point of me showing you Visual Studio and SSDT and SSMS, just to re-emphasize that, you know, there's nothing unique and special about Azure Database. It's just another database platform as far as those tools are concerned. And from a platform standpoint, we support basically the platforms you're using today, .NET, Java, Ruby on Rails, Node.js. And the management portal that you've seen is HTML5 based, so it'll run on any HTML5 compliant browser. So those are the tools and platforms. So let's finally wrap this up and summarize. I hope you've seen through this kind of whistle-stop tour that it's a rich and robust platform. It's database as a service, so it's, again, this simple to use, easy to access, with these quite incredible capabilities now coming on. So we're making, we're delivering new features every month to the tool. So the auditing was just released. The additions themselves went GA in September. And then, you know, sort of watch this space. There's more coming. Expect a sort of rolling series of upgrades with some exciting new things that, which I'd love to be able to talk to you about, but I can't. Very much provision and pay as you go. And the whole model of pay as you go and scale as you go means that your costs now, your cost curve, can pretty well track the value curve that you have from using the database. You've seen the scale up story, both scaling up and scaling out, and you've seen me discuss the business continuity story, both the recovery from sort of these oops moments through to protection from data center disasters should they ever occur. Platform itself is compliant, secure, and auditable. So frankly, all of the characteristics, I believe, make the platform enterprise grade and ready for business critical applications now to be deployed on it. Okay, that's it. Thank you very much. I said I would give you some pointers to follow-on sessions. So there are these two great sessions later in the week that will do a deep dive. The first one is a deep dive into the business continuity and auditing, and then the second one is on performance and scale-out. So in that second one, you'll see much more done on the scale-out story. You'll see the you'll see that illustrated and demonstrated. And I'm available. I'll be available either right here now or just outside if you have any questions. And also at the country drinks, I'll be there. I'm probably going to go to the, you can tell from my accent, I'm from England originally, so I should probably go to the English location there. And then I'll be in the Ask the Experts Hall on Thursday. And I'll be in and out of the expo at various times during the week. But if you have any quick questions now, I'm happy to take them. Thank you, anyway, very much.